Hello, Food Chain. This is Sharon Chittone, and I'm a food tech junkie and innovation nerd who loves a good story. This podcast combines all of my favorite vices into a deep dive about the problems our food system faces and the visionary people working on solutions. Welcome to today's episode. I am thrilled to introduce a visionary guest, Douglas Gayton, the mind behind The Lexicon, an organization that is redefining our dialogue around sustainability and food systems and more. And today we delve into the culmination of his latest groundbreaking work and the exciting launch of Can You Change the Future? An ecological benefit platform designed to empower actionable change. This platform is more than a conversation starter, it's a call to action, a bridge between knowledge and practice. So prepare to be inspired as we explore how Douglas's latest endeavor is set to transform our environmental narrative and truly change the future. Are you ready? Here we go. Hi, Doug. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. I'm super curious to learn more about everything that you're doing, which is a lot. But before we get started, can you tell us a little bit about you, who you are, and how you got started in food systems?
Sure. I'm a co-founder of The Lexicon, which is a nonprofit based in Northern California that works at the intersection of food, agriculture, conservation, and climate change. It's been an interesting journey. We began as storytellers. I'm a filmmaker and a photographer. And so we began with a television series for an American broadcaster, PBS, called Know Your Food. And then from there, we've had about 2,000 exhibits just in the United States of our artwork that explain sustainability. And they've been turning to curriculum for schools. They've been books and so forth. And so those works really were just a tremendous opportunity because it allowed us to work directly with their foremost exemplars of what sustainability is. And these experts are, in their generosity, really shared their lives, their work with us across so many areas, whether it's how food is grown to how organics works or how dairies work or regenerative agriculture. So it's been an amazing journey. And that led to an evolution of our work where we began as just storytellers and evolved into what do you do when you have so many experts that you know, when you hear so many amazing ideas and how do you take those ideas and bring people together to put their solutions to big problems, big challenges we face into action. And so we transformed the organization to an organization that goes beyond just storytelling. Like, how do you mobilize experts across a domain area and get them to collaborate on the solutions that they always talk about? And so that's what we do now. We have a model which is like an accelerator for good ideas that looks at dozens of areas across the food space. And it's really allowed us to take that storytelling part of what we do and actually apply it to tools that people can use in the farthest corners of food systems to really have real world impacts.
And we will talk about some of those ideas in a second, but obviously, as you very well know, we have tons of challenges. And one of the biggest challenges that I feel is out there is that there is no shared language or framework, which is something that you are quite a specialist about. So can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts about that and what you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, when we began our activators, the very first question that we confronted is we need to probably start by having a common language. That might be a good idea. I think anybody that's gone to a conference knows that you go to a conference and at some point it's guaranteed that someone will say, we need a common language. Because we do.
Yeah.
People feel that insights or clarity about how to confront something or how to explain something is actually proprietary. And people think that because they've come up with a really great way to explain something, that it should be trademarked or it's our differentiator in the marketplace, that it should be on our package. And what they don't realize is that you create more confusion by trying to make proprietary what is really the most important thing we need to have, which is a clarity and greater understanding. I mean, we certainly see that in the alternative protein space, yeah, where every idea that could be used to make things clear for people is suddenly turned into proprietary corporate language to explain a market differentiator. And so it's the big problem that people have in food systems, because to begin with, it already is totally opaque. People have no idea what's in their food. So any opportunity that we have to give people a window to part the curtains just ever so slightly so people can see into how food is made is actually useful, because time and time again, we know that people actually are willing to even pay more if they can make a purchase based upon their values, right? It's just proven time and time again, whether it's the cage-free egg or antibiotics in meat or hormones in milk. If you can write on a package something, somebody can understand it, then they will actually vote according to their values. You can change entire verticals in the food system. So the industrial food system does not want that. They do not want you to actually think about, even for a second, that there's ingredients in food that you, or processes used to making the food, that you might not be aligned with personally, or that might not sync with your values. So when we began our work with this model, which we call these activators, these accelerators for good ideas, the very first one we did was, can we create a universal language for food? And it turns out two things. One, turns out you can. And turns out it's really, really hard, because you've got to figure out how to make it machine readable. It has to be able to fit as a little bug on a food packet, potentially. It has to be something that can be clear enough and crisp enough that people across cultures, across borders can grok. But you also have to take into account that how many is too many, right? So right now, we're 4 years in to this LexiCon model that we've developed, developed with Adobe, developed with Google, and developed with the UN and with the FAO. And we're at 3,000 terms right now, and the list is growing. And it's not that we would expect people to know 3,000 terms, but you reward people for the deeper they go. And anyway, any tool that we can use that allows consumers to be able to have a deeper understanding of their food is going to result in a food system that's more closely aligned with our values. And I think the problems that we're facing globally, you know, whether it's climate change or loss of biodiversity, which is a forever event, right? Or desertification, these are all global challenges that come from models of agriculture or food system models that degrade instead of restore, right? So I think certainly with Gen Z, having a daughter myself, they're no longer waiting for governments to fix their problems. They're no longer waiting for companies to fix their problems. They realize that all of those groups have had their chance and have squandered the opportunity or ignored all of the signs that were blinking in front of their eyes that they needed to take action. And so they're ready to take action themselves. So we need to arm them with as much information as possible. And it starts with just the basic building blocks of ideas, the individual words and terms that if they knew them, they could be much more readily able to address these challenges that so far we failed to do ourselves.
Wow, there's a lot to unpack here. So two questions, obviously. I assume by what you were saying that these icons are the ones like we see on our computer, Chrome, Word, Apple Podcast. These kind of icons are what makes this language. And you brought up Gen Z, which is interesting. As you know, I also have a daughter, and it's clear how this generation is purpose-driven. But I also see how social media can be a big, let's say, input to create a very fragmented society and polarize the society, because as we very well know, everything is an algorithm. So here's my two questions for you. What are your thoughts on that? And how does the lexicon and these icons work?
Well, our first challenge was, can we create a language that goes beyond language that goes beyond borders, that goes beyond those boundaries? And can it be universal, machine readable, visual? So we developed a system working really close. It turns out Adobe has an ICOM team. Where are they based? They're based in Hamburg, Germany. So for 1 year, this team developed a system that any designer could use, that if they used the system, all the icons would all look like they were of the same family. So that was the first technical challenge. Then there's the implementation challenge. How do you get people to use it? Well, it's been amazing to be in this partnership with the UN and FAO because it's unlocked all sorts of opportunities. But more importantly, you have to use them. And I would imagine in three areas. One, into communicating to consumers. Two, very valuable for supply chain tools to help purchasers understand how to insert valuations into their ingredients that they're sourcing that align with the mission of a company. So this is a much more faster, efficacious way. The third thing is people are increasingly, whether it's in regenerative agriculture or just all across agriculture, there's a move away from certifications that are really practice-based to a model that is outcome-based. In other words, okay, I did these things, but what I really want to know is what happened. And often the what happened isn't codified in a formal way. So having a machine-readable visual language that helps you to visually understand what those outcomes looks like, it turns out is really, really important because we're moving out of the checking the boxes of I've done all these things into help me visualize what happened as a result model. And that's where this visual system that we've built is going to be so important, is that we need to show what success looks like. Because I can tell you what we're really good at as a species. We're super good at crisis pornography, right? We're really awesome at showing all the bad things that happen. And we just can gravitate to that, right? But we're not really good at visualizing what success looks like. And we're not really good at getting out of that model of the, I would call the crisis pornography model, into the visualizing success model. So this visual system is really key to show activities that an individual or a company or an organization are doing that are leading to those impacts that we all want to see.
Got it. If you think about it, I mean, even when success, when you have companies that are successful in doing something good, it's very difficult to then unify it. I mean, food is such a broad, difficult, complex system, right? It's not like big pharma. It's not like energy. It's not one size, like one product fits whatever. It's many different things with many different people, with many different possible outcomes. Where even if you use a technology like blockchain and you don't have a common language, you're going to have a gazillion very different results.
Yeah.
They don't speak within each other.
Well, the thing about it is that I think until now, a lot of the work of food companies, even if well-meaning, has been misplaced in the sense that in their desire to explain to a consumer or to support, let's say, food producers on the ground, farmers and ranchers and such on the ground, they are searching for models that they can support through their purchases that they can then, which to align with their mission as a company, which they can then communicate to the consumer. But the problem is, if you look at regenerative agriculture or nature positive solutions or climate smart agriculture or organic agriculture, or if you then make compounds, regenerative organic agriculture or whatever other compounds will come next week, those are all orthodoxies in the sense that they're telling each other, well, this is how I till the soil, or this is how I don't till the soil, right? In the case of regenerative, or this is how I should weed, or this is how I apply water. And they get into these very specific arguments about how something should be done.
Yes.
And people like a food company try to buy from supporting one of those things. But what the problem that they have, well, they have two problems. One, they try to make a universal decision like this is what regenerative agriculture is. But the reality is that regenerative agriculture might be universal, but it's actually place-based. It's literally a localized response to a specific set of opportunities or challenges that you face, whether it's soil or availability of labor or water or what have you. And so companies, because they're sourcing from a global supply chain based upon price and availability, they can't really handle the complexity of a place-based model for anything in terms of sourcing, because they're aggregating everything. It's all being put into a common pool and then put on a boater. So they can't really align with a place-based model. But yet the definition of regenerative is it's a set of universal principles that are applied in place. So anytime you see a large food company talking about regenerative, it has to be met with a very large degree of skepticism. And secondly, regenerative agriculture, organic agriculture, climate smart agriculture, nature positive solutions, these are all what you would call orthodoxies in the sense that they're different visions of the same thing. But what the one thing they do have in common, the one thing that's universal between them is they don't explain the what happened as a result, the outcome. And that is the shortcoming of these models. In the same way, you could say that true cost accounting, which is really great at showing a negative externality, or the circular economy, it's great to show the negative externality across the entire life cycle or something. Those are great at showing you the negative part, but they don't explain the positive outcomes when you do something right. So all these models are essentially middleware in the sense that, if you use a software term, they're the middle of something. They're actually not the endpoint. The endpoint is I did this, which was amazing, which was awesome. And then therefore, what happened? They all lack the what happened. And I think we're at a time of great existential danger as a species. We should probably maybe argue less about how to till the soil and argue more about how we're going to positively impact and address the greatest challenges we face as a species.
Yeah. And so how do you go from extractive to restorative?
Well, that's the question, right? That's the million-dollar question. I can tell you that we run an activator, which is like an accelerator for good ideas, for 5 years. And we've had about 1,000 companies in it. And companies and NGOs. And it's been amazing to see a common denominator unfold in all that work. And in a way, it almost became predictable at a certain point, which is that all of these amazing domain experts, whether it's in alternative proteins or biodiversity or food packaging, all of the common denominators, I mean, the common denominator that emerged from all of those groups was certifications are certainly important. Listen, when I go to the store, if it says organic, I'm going to buy the organic one. I'm not even going to think twice about it, right? Because I know enough about food to know what that means. But going beyond certifications, what I would really care most about is, how is this changing the world? What positive impact? And what was amazing about the activators that we have is that they all ended up with the same six. The common denominators of all these are the same six. It's air, water, soil, biodiversity, equity, and carbon. And it almost ended up being like a card trick you would show at a dinner party, where at the end, they would all come up with the same six, and I'd go, no, and I was constantly being amazed, like, how is that possible? So when we realized that it was a common denominator, we began testing it with companies and asking them to explain their ESG reporting. And lo and behold, no one could explain their ESG reporting outside of those six: air, water, soil, biodiversity, equity, and carbon. So Then we thought, well, this is amazing, but what do you do with it? So we didn't know what to do with it. You know, we were stuck, right? But folks that work at Carbon Markets approached us and they said, hey, we see you've done all of these different activators, and have you ever thought of doing one for a carbon market? And we said, no, we couldn't actually do a carbon market one, because carbon's a fraction of a whole. And so you get in trouble really quickly if you try to devise a solution to something that's fractional, because all you're doing is creating unintended consequences someplace else. So no, couldn't do carbon. I said, however, we do have this one thing that is pretty unusual. We don't know what to do with it, but it is in the food space and the agriculture space. It is the common denominator that is the outcome, the impacts that people want. And it's these six things. And so Ripple, which is very active in global financial markets, they're that cryptocurrency XRP that moves between banks. The founder of Ripple, and they have an amazing guy who leads their impact, Ripple Impact. They said, okay, we have no idea where this is going to go. Let's see if you can use that same model that you used before, these activators in these other spaces, and let's see what you can, if you can get alignment. That alignment happened very fast. Because if I was to explain carbon markets to somebody in 2030 or 2035, they would probably burst out laughing. I would say the entire planetary response to the greatest existential threat we ever face as a species, climate change, was a carbon market that somehow became privatized, and it actually became a way for people to make money by not actually joining forces and working together, by having individual different marketplaces of dubious value where they could extract a financial benefit from something that they couldn't quite explain in a market that was competing against all the other parts. If I was to explain that, you would just burst out laughing. You'd be like, that would never happen. The species, how many billion? I would say, I don't know, 6 or 7 billion. And that species of 6 or 7 billion, their greatest response to the greatest existential challenge that they ever faced was a privatized market where what was being transacted was of dubious value. And I'd say, ooh, well, we also had ESG reporting. And they'd look like I was crazy, like I was a crazy person. And it's because we're asking a carbon market to do what it was never asked to do. We're asking ESG and ESG reporting to do what it was never asked to do, because they, from the very beginning of how they were built in a privatized mindset, and they were built not with a holistic model in mind that was a standardized framework. And so as crazy as that might sound, that is what we have, right?
Yeah.
And I'm reminded, Sharon, you lived for many years in Italy. You know, there's a phrase, tutti in piazza, right? And I remember the first time I heard it, I was literally in a bar having an espresso in the morning, and somebody came in and yelled tutti in piazza, and they all stormed out, and I put my espresso down, and the man behind the bar pointed at the door like I was supposed to follow everybody, and I ended up on the piazza, and I said, what's going on? They said, they're going to change the salary of the teachers, and we have to show our support for the teachers. And so they're chanting I don't even know what's going on, I'm chanting, and somebody says, and I said, so tutti in piazza? They're like, yeah, everybody to the piazza. Everybody goes to the piazza, tutti in piazza. And someone said, how do you say that in English? I said, I'm not sure you can. They said, well, come on, you can translate. And I said, I think I would say take to the streets.
Yeah.
And they said, well, that's dispersive. The streets go everywhere. Tutti in piazza is everybody comes together. And I never forgot that, the power and the importance of precision in language, first of all. But secondly, models that are a take to the street model actually make a lot of noise, but don't result in much, mm-hmm. You know? And as my Italian friends pointed out, in the 2000 election, when the Americans took to the streets, actually nothing happened, right? Because they didn't have a piazza to gravitate to, metaphorically and physically. So we need to have models, and we need to have movement building that's designed to bring people to the piazza together.
Nice try. Very, very true. And in part, that's what both of our work has been a lot about. Convergence, right?
Yeah, because you never know, right? You never know when you bring people together, not only what insights, and also people don't know. Like, people come to gatherings that are not totally scripted. And great things sometimes come out of those things because things are unlocked within them that they didn't even know was there, right? They might have thought that it was just a very small idea that no one else would take hold of. And then they get into a group and they find that there is greater alignment than they once thought. it's certainly the model we use in all of on all these activators that we do, is that it's important for people to know that whatever challenge that a sector is facing isn't overwhelming if the response to that challenge is distributed. And so that distributed model is really, really important.
So what's missing? I mean, we live in a very individualistic society. We try to bring about collaboration and unity and two-team piazza, bring people to think systemically, holistically, and implement solutions that are holistic and have that globalized approach, but with a localized, obviously, solution, because it has to be that way. But in reality, what's really going on is that there is a lot of fighting and competition instead of collaboration. We live in a world that one solution in terms of regenerative agriculture, alternative protein, it's, as you said before, what does it really mean? It's not just a global set of principles. It has to be applied in a localized manner.
Yeah. Well, you know, Gil Scott-Heron tremendously undervalued in his insight and genius once wrote a poem, it became a song, "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised," right? And so I think what we need to accept is that the revolution cannot be owned. It cannot be owned by an individual company or an individual brand. The revolution, it has to take place in the commons, and the revolution has to be built upon, certainly by private stakeholders, but not owned by private stakeholders. And I think that with carbon markets, with ESG reporting, there's been this sense of ownership that, or this sense of individualistic versus pluralistic thinking. And we're not really going to solve the world's problems if we don't coalesce around shared responses to it that are built on, that are supported by common framework. And so the ecological benefits framework that came out of all of this work is now what we're building. So it came out of the 5 years of this activator model, which was originally funded by Google, of 1,000-something companies and organizations that then evolved into this ecological benefit framework. That was the epiphany that we had, that this is what the common denominator was. Okay, now let's focus on that, which now has hundreds and hundreds of stakeholders around the world that are working on that. And I think that we're going to see the expression of this framework in so many ways. It's going to help government organizations explain the positive impacts they're creating. And most importantly, it's going to give us a way to visualize a different way of thinking about the challenges of the world. Right now, we live in a model that is a do less form model, right? It's the idiocy that ended up with the climate movement using as their symbol a polar bear on an ice floe. You're never going to eat a polar bear. You're never going to be in an ice floe. You're never going to know what you did to put the polar bear on the ice floe specifically. You're not going to know what you're going to be able to do in your action to get the polar bear off the ice floe. So you've literally said, if you're in the climate movement and you present that as your model, as your motif, as your symbol, you're literally saying, I'm giving you permission to check out of this conversation, because it has nothing to do with you in any way, nor is your response in any way connected to that polar bear. And that is a do less harm model, right? Nine planetary boundaries are amazing, but imagine how much more amazing it would be if it was nine planetary opportunities, right? And negative externalities, true cost accounting. Imagine if we had a different model for that, which was about six positive impacts, that your activity that you were doing wasn't doing less bad, but was contributing to positive impacts in air and water and soil and biodiversity and equity and carbon. It's these types of models that are also extremely powerful for the global South, because carbon markets locked the global South out of the conversation. It was just a circular, let's feel less bad about doing bad model among companies that had negative energy coefficients to feel better about themselves. But the global biodiversity stock is being maintained and managed by people in the global South, at the lungs of the planet, the Amazon, global South. All of the most important assets for our survival
are in the hands of people who are not being remunerated for it.
Yes.
So the entire way to value all of these assets has to be completely rethought. We're using the completely wrong model. And if you think about Buckminster Fuller, an American inventor and architect who said, if you want to replace the existing model, simply build another model that makes the existing model obsolete. So it's not like, let's take down carbon markets or let's take down ESG reporting. My argument is they're built on such a unstable framework, they're going to bring themselves down, right? As we've already seen with voluntary carbon markets, and we've already seen with all the pushback against ESG. We need to build models that are much more responsive, much easier to understand in response to the world's greatest challenges. I mean, I'm only talking, it's a modest proposal, Sharon. It's six words, right? Can we align at least first to start with six words, and then can we build out from that? And I think that's a pretty modest proposal in the face of the challenges that we're dealing with.
It is a modest proposal, although it's not necessarily an easy one to get the right people then to do it. And how do we adopt it?
Well, look at the software industry. So Steve Jobs comes out and does an Apple keynote. And if you haven't seen it, you should go track it down on YouTube and find it. It's so amazing. He gives his keynote and then he ends it. And then he goes, oh, and by the way, one final thing. He takes out the iPhone, right? And it changed everything. Suddenly you had a smartphone in your pocket, right? Could do all these powerful things. But you know, Samsung was right there, right? And all the other appliance makers were right there and making smartphones at the same time. And each of them were trying to build a bull cat. They were trying to figure out how to own that space, which could not be owned by an individual company, but how could they try? And then you had smart devices. You had smart refrigerators and smart doorbells and smart cars suddenly. Imagine if every single one of those smartphone makers had to go to every single one of those appliance makers and make their own technology deal to connect their phone to that device. It would have been
nightmare. It
would have been craziness. And so instead, what the world said is, we have to come up with a universal way to connect these two things with each other. And end up being Bluetooth, right? So now you have Bluetooth, which is this digital handshake that allows any smartphone to talk to any smart device, any smart appliance. And by having a standardization, having Bluetooth, which by the way is a nonprofit, right? By having that standardization, there was a rapid acceleration of the deployment of new technologies that could be used by smartphones and that could be used by smart appliances, because they were freed up of having to adjudicate every single handshake between every single device, right? The ecological benefit framework is essentially proposing a digital handshake for the planet. How can we come up with a standardized way for an NGO or a project of an NGO or a company or a product of a company or a vehicle used by impact investors, you know, or government agencies that are developing programs and the people that are on the ground that are actually doing those activities or that are funding those activities? We have to standardize how we talk about the positive impacts that are being created by our activities. Because it doesn't matter what you are, whether you're an impact investor or a philanthropic or a family office or a government agency or a company, it doesn't matter what you are. You're all going to be, we're not saying that people should follow the same path, but we can at least, I hope, agree on the same destination. And that destination should be aligned on those six impacts that we care about most. And that is what the ecological benefit framework is. It's a digital handshake that we propose for the planet.
Well, and you took it also one step further. I mean, you're building this.
We're building it. I think one of the things that we learned in the activators from the very beginning is that when you bring together a lot of experts in one group, the common denominator is they all know how to write pretty well. So usually what comes out of a working group or is a list of recommendations, right? And usually in a white paper, which they might make into a PDF, right? So from the very beginning of our work, we said, if we're going to bring people together, we have to build stuff. And the model that we have is to identify all those domain experts, bring them together and mobilize them, get them to agree on what the challenge is, how they're going to address it, and reach consensus on that and then build all those consensus tools. So if you go to changethefuture.org, you're going to begin to see the first phase of these consensus tools that are being built by the hundreds of stakeholders that have been gathered across carbon markets, currencies, blockchain. It's an amazing collection of people that have gathered because they see the value in having an alignment that can unify all these disparate activities that before now have led to where we are now with voluntary carbon markets that have no trust and ESG reporting that is crumbling up before us. So we need to have, it's a perfect time for a unifying framework. And I think that's why all of these stakeholders have joined in.
Just fantastic. Couple of questions before I talked about fragmentation, polarization, which is something that we see pretty much everywhere. And of course, on our end, we also see the big lobbies, the big pushback of climate change does not exist or junk food is good for you. How do we go around that, which is a very powerful force?
Well, I think often it's easy to oppose something if it has a singular intent, because you can just take an oppositional stance to that intent. So in the case of climate change, you can deny climate change. Well, it turns out you can't deny biodiversity loss, right? You can't deny desertification. You can't deny water scarcity. Yeah, these are, the ecological benefit framework is multidimensional because the challenges are multidimensional, which makes it much harder for someone who is a climate denier. You can be a climate denier, but you can't really deny that there's biodiversity loss. This is very easily quantifiable. You can't deny that there's desertification happening across sub-Saharan Africa, across Southeast Asia. So these are things that are not deniable using the logic that's used by climate deniers. So that's the first thing, right? That's the first thing, is that it has a multiplicity of aspects to it. The other thing is, it's a framework. It's not prescriptive in the sense that Bluetooth doesn't tell you, hey, you know what? Buy the Samsung phone. Don't buy the Apple phone. What Bluetooth says is, can we agree that we need to have a digital handshake to enable activity between a buyer and a seller, right? And it's between a technology and its implementation, or whatever those metaphors are between the two actors, right? It's much harder to oppose something like that using the standard framing that's been used. But also, you could also argue at the same time, do we even care? In the sense that all energy, effort, and focus should be on millennials, on providing them those tools now, to providing them the framework and the infrastructural buildup that's going to be required, so that when they're ready, which they are increasingly are ready, and they're increasingly are, that we are building something for them to use. Those people that are in all of these places of these legacy positions inside of government agencies and family offices and companies and organizations, we need to be restructuring and rewiring the framework so that it's ready for millennials to then take the reins of this and drive it. And we know that they are going to be much more positive impact oriented than do less bad oriented. So rewiring those frameworks now for them might be the greatest gift, since we're not going to actually see this through. Those of us, speaking for myself, those of us that are older, we need to be building that framework now that is going to be perfectly aligned with where they're thinking now. And so that when they take these reins, as they are already taking these reins, and that they have the support structure behind them.
Yes. And I do agree. I see both on the millennial side, both on the and the Gen Z side, this want, especially because, I mean, let's face it, we did destroy a planet and that created so many problems for them that they had to take hold of their life and simply say, even on a work, let's call it ethic change, it's like, I'm going to think about my well-being while I look for a job. And in our time, it was, I'm going to be a slave and work and work and work. If not, they fire me. And then I will get to a point where I can sort of lay back and be happy with my position. I'll put in my 90-hour week.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you know, I think at companies, people could do a lot within a company. For example, there's a lot you could do within supply chain, within purchasing supply chains, where you can still support the mission of a company and still support what your requirement is as a supply chain purchaser, for example. So you're supposed to buy what's available at the cheapest possible price and have a steady stream of whatever that you're sourcing, whatever ingredient that you're purchasing. But at the same time, there is the opportunity to apply a different filter to what you're buying. And that filter could be making purchases that are much more aligned with your personal values. So I think there's all kinds of ways that even within large companies, you can impact and the activities of the company, not from the top, but from within. And that sharing of a different way of looking at things, sharing of deeper insights, helping to get companies out of a do less bad model into a do more good model. Those are all things that aren't top down. I mean, they're great if they are top down, obviously. But the operationalizing of those ideas are going to be in the middle of a company.
Yeah.
In the supply chain. If it's a retail company, then among people on the retail side. We all have to change our thinking. And people ask me, Sharon, if I'm optimistic. In the very beginning of the lexicon, my partner, hey, you know what? We're not going to show stories about how bad things are. That's too easy. As I told you before, that's just crisis pornography, right? Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to show solutions and only solutions because they're much harder to find, much more challenging. You got to find who these things, you have to, you know, ferret out the actual solutions from the ones that are fake solutions. But if you can actually document a solution and you can share the insights of a person who is creating solutions, you're capturing the problem in that. You're explaining the problem, but you're explaining the problem in the context of how to approach the problem and then overcome it. And so we need to have a solution-oriented mindset, a positive outcome mindset, a do more good mindset. And all of that is, I think, embodied in the ecological benefits framework, because it's saying at the end of the day, what we really need to do is just know that all of our activities, no matter what, in sum total, need to somehow address the challenges we face by leaning into and supporting the impacts that we all need to be contributing to. And so it's a rewiring of our brains to think with a more positive outlook and more focused on the fact that it's all of those little actions that are going to add up to great change. It's like when you see political candidates that run for office that never take big donations, that take small donations from hundreds of thousands, they all add up. They all add up. And so that's what we're trying to get people to embrace and to shift from that mindset into this other mindset.
Very important. And we know it's like with the art of positive thinking, it takes practice. And we talked a lot about private companies. What's the role of policymakers and policy in general? Huge, in my opinion, but.
Yeah, I mean. I once had a funny conversation with an economist, a global economist at the UN. And we were talking about food waste. And he said, Douglas, you're one of these activists that you think food waste is eating the stem of the broccoli. And you're like, I got to eat the whole stem because otherwise it's food waste. But if you talk to an economist, food waste is how do you get more solar powered refrigeration units in sub-Saharan Africa? Because all that stuff in the fields doesn't make it to market because they don't have any refrigeration units, but they're not on the grid. So it has to be solar powered. So you think about the broccoli stalk and I think about how to get solar powered refrigeration units in sub-Saharan Africa, right? It's the scale. Right. And so policy is how do you address things at scale? Right. And none of this that we're talking about will matter ultimately if we don't come up with ways to address these things at scale. The irony is, Sharon, this is the irony of that. So, of course, numbers, scale, got it. Straightforward, super simple, get it. But the flip side of that is, if you want to enact policy, policymakers will demand to see that there's interest on the ground before they take action. So you might say, I don't need to worry about the broccoli stem because somebody's going to figure out the solar power refrigeration unit for sub-Saharan Africa. So I don't got to worry about the broccoli stem. But the reality is that both have to happen at the same time because people on the ground need to take food loss and waste seriously because that sends signals up to the top of the system to policymakers like, wow, there's people are like eating the broccoli stem because they're considering that food waste. That has seismic impacts on thinking at the top level. They're going to be like, wow, there's a public will to support this. What can we be doing at a regional or national level? Well, we need to do these seismic shifts in how laws work or how policy is implemented. So it literally has to happen at both scales at the same time. And both are equally important, by the way, right? Because we should all be thinking that every action that we do is a contributor and that everything, there's power in those cumulative impacts, right?
Oh, absolutely. Reaction has a reaction. And as you said, even with food waste, for example, however you slice it, there is a cumulative impact that goes from, you know, the whole value chain, with obviously a result being that one third of our food is wasted. And it's never one little piece. It's the cumulative piece.
And when you talk about the complexity of a food system, food loss and waste is one thing, which was why we created the lexicon, because the problem in many cases that people don't even know that there's a problem. The problem is, and if they understand the problem, they don't have the language to talk about the problem. And if you don't have the language to talk about the problem, you're less likely to see yourself as an agent who is part of the change. And so it's really important to get people to understand not just the problem, but the language around the problem, because words are the building blocks of ideas, right? If you can give people those words, I often say the most subversive thing you could ever do is teach somebody a new word. Because once you've taught somebody a new word, you've introduced new wiring into their brain. And suddenly they're going to be able to put two words together or three words together and phrases together and develop a way to actually then express what their values are in a way that they never even had an opinion about before, because they didn't even understand it. So we talked about food loss and waste, but you could apply that to so many other challenges across food systems, whether it's equity or whether it's all of the challenge you have in growing food and rewarding people for their practices. If you don't understand what regenerative agriculture is, then you can't really understand who to support or why. And so that's the great challenge. That's why the importance of learning the language of something is foundational. It's fundamental. If you don't have that shared vocabulary, it's going to be well nigh impossible to get someone to shift their way of thinking.
So as a sort of a last key takeaway for people in the industry and for listeners that don't directly work in around food, what are some of the actions that we as people could take?
I think that when we began the lexicon, we had hundreds of terms. And I remember I was in a classroom. It's always great to get in front of kids to share what you're working on, to explain it. And though I would, in some ways, even defend it, because they will ask the questions that get to the heart of the why you're doing what you're doing and if it's worthwhile or useful. But I had a list of words that I put on the board. And the kid said to me, that's a lot of words. That's a lot of work. And I never forgot that, because the industrial food system has benefited greatly by us having no idea what's in our food, right? We used to think of food as something that gave us nutrition, right? Now we think of food in terms of at the lowest possible price, right? And so the idea of nutrition has gone away. People talk about deliciousness That's the most important thing in food. If you're in a food company, the term that's used is deliciousness, right? But actually, it is supposed to be about nutrition, right? But consumers is not about neither of those two. It's about price, right? And so if we want to have a food system that reflects our values, we're going to have to somehow find a way to get beyond the opaqueness that defines what food systems are now, to give people greater visibility into how food is grown or what's in the food products that they eat. And that comes, sadly, I mean, I say sadly because it requires work, that comes with literacy, that comes with being fluent, that comes with fluency, that comes with having a different, a much more expandable vocabulary, which allows you to unlock a much deeper understanding of what a food system is. And that is work, unfortunately. And so it didn't require that same work 100 years ago. The food system was much simpler and food products were much simpler, but now it's different. We are in a global economy and we have not one person could pronounce even a third of the ingredients on a loaf of bread if they look at the ingredient deck, right?
Right.
And so therefore, what we really are, it's this existential challenge we face is, are we going to take that food system back? Are we going to take ownership back? Are we going to get a food system that's more aligned with our values? Are we going to get away from a food system based upon the cheapest possible price to one that nourishes us? And sure, absolutely delicious. But all of that is work, right? All of that is us having to invest that time and energy in a way that allows us to make decisions according to values. I would feel like that was an insurmountable task, but it's not, because I, as I told you previously, when consumers learned what a cage-free egg was, when they learned what antibiotics in meat were, when they learned what growth hormones were in milk, when they learned about what was in the food that they ate and they were able to actually vote against that in support of their values, that was really powerful. Imagine if we could get them to understand their food in terms of six words. Imagine if they could understand their food system in terms of what is contributing to the six things they care about most. What could be more simple? So I think I would just leave you with that. You know, can we get to a food system that can be reoriented in terms of how it explains its activities, so it explains what it is contributing to in a way that consumers can align with? That is the question that I'm asking people. That is what the ecological benefits framework is. It's a complete shift of how we're thinking, more oriented to the change we want to see in the world, which is why the website for the ecological benefits framework is canyouchangethefuture.org, because that is the question that I would leave you and your audience with.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Great. Thanks for having me.
Want to dive deep into food innovation? Subscribe to the Food Tech Junkie series. Tune in and listen to the industry's champions whose mission is to reinvent our future by collaborating and disrupting the status quo as a way to rebalance our planet in our daily lives. For more great content, visit our website at www.edibleplanetventures.com and follow us on social media on the Edible Planet Ventures channels.